Welcome to In Social Work, the podcast series of the University of Buffalo School of Social Work at www.insocialwork.org. We're glad you could join us today. The purpose of In Social Work is to engage practitioners and researchers in lifelong learning and to promote research to practice and practice to research. We educate, we connect, we care. We're in social work.
Hi from Buffalo. Right now we're celebrating and enjoying life here at UB and across Western New York as the UB men's basketball team qualified for the NCAA March Madness basketball tournament. It's UB's first ever trip to the Big Dance. I'm Peter Sabota. In this episode, our guest, Dr. Richard Smith, discusses his attendance and experiences at the 2012 UN Conference on Sustainable Development in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and comments on the implications for social work practice. Dr. Smith begins by defining social development and its role in eradicating poverty in communities. He goes on to describe the goals of the conference as well as his observations while in Rio de Janeiro. He concludes with discussion and recommendations on how to combine social work practice and principles of sustainable development. Dr. Richard Smith, PhD, MSW, is assistant professor at Wayne State University School of Social Work. His research interests include sustainable community development, inequality, and migration. His previous experience includes serving in the Peace Corps in Mongolia and consulting work with UNICEF and the World Bank. Dr. Smith was interviewed by our own Dr. Shanta Murshid, assistant professor at the UB School of Social Work. Dr. Smith was interviewed in November of 2014.
Dr. Smith, welcome to the UB School of Social Work. I am Shanta Murshid, and I will be talking to you about sustainable development. So when we think about sustainable development, we think about how we can perhaps intergenerationally transmit resources, social, economic, environmental. But could you tell us how you define sustainable development, and really why should social workers be concerned about this?
That's a great question, and I'm very happy to be on this podcast. As a starting point, I would start with, but not end with, the Brundtland definition of sustainable development. And this came out of a United Nations report in 1987. And the metaphor they used was the three-legged stool of sustainability, one leg being the economy, one being the environment, and one being society, the social or community. And that's the part where that third part, society, that's the part that social work would be most obviously aligned. On an administrative level, as the UN is structured and many national government or member states are structured, you will have an environment ministry, you will have a social development ministry. And for those like me who are from the United States, other countries call this entity a social development ministry. That's what the UN calls it. We generally call these health and human services ministries or social service departments, but that would be the word used internationally, as is what the profession of social work is called internationally. Now, they also have finance ministers or treasury ministers, as in our case. And it was a way of showing that how these three values, also functions of government, could need to collaborate to ensure sustainability. And what does that mean? It means that, as you said, future generations are not compromised by the decisions we make today. So going forward, several generations, individuals, families, communities will still be able to have levels of well-being that's not compromised by our lack of foresight, by using non-renewable resources, or even managing fiscal resources in a way that does not provide a future for our children. Now, the reason I said it doesn't have to end there, I think there are different criticisms of what's missing. Why is it only three legs, not four? And different scholars will propose various fourth stools of a leg. One of my colleagues here is interested in a cultural pillar.
What's your pillar?
I've mostly been focusing on, within the social, thinking about community participation, that in between the economic and the social, really thinking about poverty and inequality in the context of place, because I believe that place matters and that
place in the world?
Yeah.
Like so geographic?
That's a good question because, yes, I did mean place in geography. There are privileged places. There are places that do not have the resources that others do. And then that interacts with other social identities of race, class, gender, right. Sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. So those are probably my two focal points of my research, place, poverty. And then because of the inequality of places, that creates push and pull factors for migration.
Yes.
People moving to jobs, people leaving sites where there were natural disasters, just like your work with disaster relief in Bangladesh.
Well, but moving on a little bit, you attended the 2012 UN Conference on Sustainable Development. And,
correct.
You know, what I'm interested in knowing is what did you see there? And more importantly, what did you hear? Can you tell us about some of that and some anecdotes about your experiences there and what you thought and perhaps a critique of what, you know, you heard and how you think social workers could benefit or not benefit from some of that?
That's a great question. I think that we were reading the press the whole time, and a lot of the U.S.-based press was vilifying the conference. And there might be good reasons to do that. But first, the context. I mentioned earlier the Brundtland. That laid a bit of the foundation. Mm-hmm. The conference I went to was also called Rio Plus 20, because right. 20 years prior was the original Rio UN Conference on Sustainable Development. And three treaties came out of that. And as far as I know, one of the backdrops was, what are we doing with our environmental treaties? These were treaties related to climate change, species loss. And it was to follow up. The United Nations as a system likes to follow up on all the treaties and conventions and documents that come up. And they do this by having a conference. This conference mm-hmm. was held, as they say in UN speak, at the highest level. That means that even though it was an environmental conference, and mm-hmm. typically that the main audience would be then the environmental ministers, right. and for our case, that was the head of the EPA, heads of state were invited. Unfortunately, the Queen of England was having her birthday party that week, so we didn't get a lot of heads of state. Well, it was like a Jubilee birthday, so.
Yeah, no, that is important.
So that was the purpose. Now, planning for this conference started way in advance, more than a year. So we had been, we meaning EcoCity Builders, that was the non-governmental organization that whose delegation I was part of. Mm-hmm. We had been looking at the quote-unquote zero draft. So a document was coming out. We knew it was not going to be a treaty. The reason we knew it would not be a treaty was because there wasn't political will among the member states to have another treaty because the feeling was we didn't want another Copenhagen. Just 2 years prior to that, there had been a conference in Copenhagen to attempt to have another round at a climate change treaty, and that did not come out with a treaty. So right. the goal in this draft was to affirm existing treaties and to, in some level, brainstorm climate adaptation. There was a pessimism that member states would not do anything to address climate change. So what was our second best solution? Mm-hmm. Some other issues that were trying to be addressed is the organization of the UN system vis-a-vis environment. One is to restructure how the agencies are structured so that the environmental agency would have a higher position within the UN system. One ask was that agency would be able to send letters to member states on the degree to which they were in compliance with existing treaties. And then finally, and the major outcome was to integrate the Millennium Development Goals was mm-hmm. a document that originated out of the social ministers in the 1995 Conference on Social Development. Mm-hmm. It was to take that document that was scheduled to end in 2015 and have a new era called the Sustainable Development Goals.
Right. So the Millennium Development Goals will become the Sustainable Development Goals.
Correct.
That's the idea.
Yeah. Beginning next year, we will not have the Millennium Development Goals. We will have a document and a website, for that matter, called the Sustainable Development Goals, with the understanding that it would include, if not all, the majority of the Millennium Development Goals, and mm-hmm. especially poverty. Especially the goals that exist currently regarding the environment, access to water, access to sanitation. And that happened. We will be starting the Sustainable Development Goals next year. Why does that matter for social workers? Well, for the last 15 years almost, all countries reported through their social ministries on mm-hmm. the Millennium Development Goals, and that set a framework for nation-state policy that is sometimes invisible to social workers in the United States because of our conflicted relationship with the United Nations.
Right.
But it's non-trivial. You know, our U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reports on those goals, and that affects how they manage child welfare systems, right. how they manage Medicare, Medicaid. And now that's internationally will be coordinated with the environmental ministers. How mm-hmm. often at the local level have social workers sat with their, you know, the county social worker sat with the county waste management personnel or the environmental compliance personnel? We might begin to see that happening because it's happening at the international level. So that was the background. Now, what did I see? You know, Rio de Janeiro is an incredible city, and it was a great backdrop for a conference on the environment. The first event I went to was on the legendary Copacabana beach, and this was my orientation, and it was at a museum, and that was when we went over all the background and received some orientation. You know, even though Rio de Janeiro, it is a city larger than any we have in the United States. It's one of the largest cities in the world. But the conference had over 20,000 delegates, and it felt like we took over the whole city, even though we were just a fraction of the people there. Security was paramount. When we registered with the United Nations, they got the address of all our hotels, and the government of Brazil stationed an army officer at the corner of every hotel, even if we were staying in a humble pensione in the hills, and they had armed guards in front of our pensione. That's we might call that a hostel in the United States,
yes,
but
yes.
It's a little nicer. It used to be an old convent, and that's why I called it a pensione. That's the Portuguese mm-hmm. name. So most people stayed downtown, and the convention center was 2 hours away by bus. It was the site that will also be site to the Olympics.
Right.
And
so they're prepping for that.
Yeah, and it's a very mammoth convention and sports complex with stadiums, convention center, and the whole convention center was surrounded with security. So the security check-in was larger than any airport I'd been in. We had the lines and the scanners,
wow.
as you can imagine.
Is there a same kind of uproar that we saw in Brazil during the World Cup?
Yes.
Terms of, oh, there is.
Let me get to that. When I was there for a full 2 weeks, so I was there for the preparatory conference. So the preparatory conference, as you imagine, it was a time for delegates from the member states to make final changes to this document. The title of the document was The Future We Want. And it was also a chance for people from the non-governmental community,
right.
namely me and us. We had panel discussions. We had planning meetings. We also had side events all over the city. And we could go in and watch the delegates debate the draft. And that had never been done before. It
right.
was the first UN conference where that was allowed. Now, the main conference was when the heads of state environmental minister came. President Obama did not come. Joseph Biden didn't come. Secretary of State Clinton came. And Lisa Johnston, EPA mm-hmm. administrator, came.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a panel with the State Department. I was not in attendance at the one with Hillary Clinton, unfortunately, because she came on the last day and I was gone by then. But the main conference was what we were here, and that was when the highest ranking official from the member state delivers the speech affirming the document that had been produced. Now, but between these two events, Brazil asked to do something rather extraordinary that also had not been done before. They had a 4-day event called Dialogue Days. And they wanted it to be open to the general public, free of charge.
Excellent.
So anyone who could get there anywhere in the world could go into the conference facility and have a structured dialogue. And to
Very
prepare for that, they had a web competition. Anyone on the planet with access to the internet could propose a sustainability solution to be debated at the UN Conference on Sustainable Development. And these
crowdsourcing ideas.
Yeah, this was the first crowdsourced UN conference.
Right. Very nice. And did you see a lot of participation from
it was incredible.
The general public? Yeah.
So the ideas were arranged into themes. And so I attended the one on sustainable employment. And I attended the one on sustainable cities.
Okay.
The main floor, they had room for, I think, 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. And it was fairly packed.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. Now, when we got in, we weren't sure what to expect. Our delegation had proposed that Dialogue Days should affirm a global system for sustainable cities. And our idea had gotten into the top 10, and we'd been working for about 5 years developing a framework with 15 categories of sustainability, both the social, environmental, financial. There was a panel discussion of experts and then about 30 minutes for open floor debate. And then the people on the floor got to vote for their favorite. And then that would be put into the record, the favorite of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And then the favorite of the panel was also entered into the record.
Did you go as part of EcoCity when you said we, that was, you meant EcoCity
yes.
builders? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, would like to know a little more about that too, but you know, finish up first.
Yeah. EcoCity Builders is a non-governmental organization based in Oakland, California that does both advocacy, education, and planning for sustainability in cities. And an eco-city is a city in balance with nature.
I see. And how do you build that? Sorry if this
yeah, no worries.
Is not a good question.
There are key principles. One is access by proximity. People okay. should be able to get where they need to go, preferably by foot. But maybe by a non-motorized transportation, bike, or a low-impact transportation, that there's access to nature. You should be able to walk out your door and see, you know.
Green.
Or, you know, if you're in the desert, maybe it isn't green. But, you know, you should be able to interact with plants, wildlife, even in the city. And the built environment of the city should support views of nature, not try to hide them. And there's more, but we've been working on a framework so that if a city wants to be certified as an eco-city, that what would that look like? What would that mean for the people, for educational systems, for healthcare? And our idea was not voted by popular vote, in part because one of the experts was from the city of Masdar, which is a built eco-city. And she raised a very good point that it's hard to come up with a system that fits for every country, every continent, every city, because deserts are very different than tropical rainforests, very different than Arctic areas. But other panelists actually elected that as their favorite. So we did, you know, I think it was good because we were able to have a discussion about the substantive issue. I will say the people voted for recycling. They voted in a recycling idea as sort of a core component of a sustainable city.
I see. Yeah, but that's something that people are doing already. So it's
right.
not like they're voting for new ideas. They're voting for something that they can do, perhaps.
Yeah, I think
that they
so.
Feel that they can be a part of without too much trouble.
Yeah, and it makes sense. And there were many, you know, it's kind of like when you're teaching the social action class and the social work curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to the town hall, you want to bring your allies, right? I know that people in recycling came out for this event, you know, you see it. That was the great thing. You know, teaching in MSW programs and being a student and having been with actions with ACOSA and at the local level, it was great to see some social movement action at the international level and how the national issues affected the international. And that's kind of, you had asked earlier, was this like the protest for the World Cup? Maybe that's a good segue. It's even though we were at the conference, we had all these side events.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a poster session at Fort Lemme overlooking Copacabana at a military museum, and that was done with the Federal University.
Okay.
But one of the side events we did is we pilot tested the Eco-Citizen World Map Project, and we identified a local partner. There were a couple local partners, one called Transition Towns, another called Catalytic Communities, Rio Watch. So Rio Watch, they have a blog in preparation for both the World Cup and Olympics to monitor gentrification and forced relocation due to the construction around the Olympic venues. They identified a neighborhood close to, but not adjacent to, the stadiums. And we went on a tour and we took our smartphones and we went with the local community center director to see what they were doing and how they navigated being at the edge of rapid change. And just to give a backdrop, it might be hard for people in the United States to appreciate this, and it was very hard for me to understand this. Historically in Brazil, if you did not live inside the city's boundaries, you could not vote in city elections. And we may find that trivial because we have people who live outside the city election. But in Brazil, there's cities and there's the province and then there's the country. If you don't live in a city, sure, maybe you can vote for the provincial governor. But there's no entity. It is the province that's responsible for infrastructure, social services, what have you. There's no entity. And who is it that is living outside of the city boundaries? Well, in order to live inside the city boundaries, you had to be a certain kind of Brazilian.
Okay, and which is what?
Of Portuguese descent. Now, this is historic going back centuries. Mm-hmm. That's no longer the case. Recently, two things happened. One is neighborhoods outside the city limits. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, I'm not talking several miles out. Sometimes, you know, the city boundaries were gerrymandered in such a way that you had rather dense urbanized areas adjacent to official city jurisdiction, but outside. And they're called favelas in Portuguese.
Okay.
And that is the name of the native tree that is in the hillsides, because usually these were neighborhoods that would run up along hillsides. And so sometime in the last generation, those areas were incorporated into the city, and so the residents were given full voting suffrage. But in the interim, they had developed their own form of governance through non-governmental organizations. They had elections. So it was very analogous to the settlement houses, except they weren't outsiders coming in, although sometimes outsiders would come in to live in favelas.
Okay. Yeah.
They were people who grew up in the favelas, started community centers, had elected boards. And as they were able to vote in local and even provincial elections, they knew how to work the system. Huh. They knew how to pull the levers to get infrastructure improvements. Because we take it for granted when we live in a city, there's an entity out there building our roads, our sidewalks, building our sewer system.
Mm-hmm.
There's an entity that contracts with a utility company to bring electricity and phone lines in or gas lines.
Mm-hmm.
So in the favela, that wasn't happening. So these NGOs, and each favela had their own, they would build their own sewer systems. They would bully the utilities through social action to get electricity. They would build their own homes. They would develop their own standards for building codes. They were actually often employed in skilled trades, so they had the skills and abilities. It was very eye-opening because it was actually a beautiful neighborhood. It was about a 3 to 4 story neighborhood, brick construction mostly. It had electricity, phones. They showed us the sewer system that they built. And now the city is going in and putting in their quote-unquote official sewer system. And you would see families sitting out in the street with maybe a folding table, and they'd have their MacBook out. The kids would be playing on a trampoline next to it. It was just a really interesting experience.
You know, that reminds me of, you know, here we see an NGO providing services that the government should have been providing in the first place. And it's really a sign of market failure. It's failed economy at its best. But how can somebody go from there? Or how can a country move from that and into a non-failed economy? And I know that's a larger question, but from what it sounds like is that, you know, it's perhaps entity like these NGOs are what can lead such neighborhoods out of poverty. And then perhaps then there can be some semblance of normalcy, which can then lead to non-failed
structure. And I think generally that was the vision. We actually had a summit of these NGO leaders from the favelas. this kind of brings me back. As I said, there are many side events. Mm-hmm. One of the traditions at a United Nations conference mm-hmm. is that NGOs will have a quote-unquote protest conference
okay.
or people's conference. And so that was actually downtown in the museum district.
But are these NGOs, they're saying that they're representing the people, but are they elected by the people? And just to clarify.
Yeah, so in Brazil, in the favelas I went to, they are. They're yeah. actually directly elected by the people.
And okay, that's so the largest critique of NGOs is that they're not democratic. So, you know, they're just right. non-governing bodies that are doing things that the government should be doing, but in very non-transparent ways. So this is an example of a transparent elected NGO.
Yeah, and as far as I know, that's the minority, right?
Yeah, this is new. this is unheard of.
I can only think of one or two nonprofits in the United States, maybe three, that have directly elected boards from the residents or members. Well, I shouldn't say that. Like, the classic example in the United States is the Dudley Street Initiative in Boston. The board is elected by the people who live in the geographic boundaries of the area that this NGO claims to represent. That is so rare. There are also models of interest to social work. You have like service providers that are cooperatives and membership based. The Village Cooperative in California, it's serving right. people with a mental illness. But outside of social work, of course, credit unions, housing cooperatives have this model. Mm-hmm. Now, back to the People's Summit where you interjected, many of the NGOs there had mm-hmm. very little to do with what I would call the people. It was mm-hmm. a little bit ironic when you see a sign that says the People's Summit sponsored by the Ford Foundation USAID for International Development. Now, yeah. I did have an internship at USAID.
Okay.
I was in the U.S. Peace Corps. I worked as a federal officer. I swore on to uphold the Constitution. But no one escaped the irony that he was the People's
That's
Summit.
That's good to know because it's funny. It's so funny. And then when people don't get that joke, it's like, okay, I'm not going to explain it to you.
Yeah. And it's so odd. But then one of the events I went there, USAID and the Vatican co-sponsored an Indigenous People's Summit. And what was interesting to me, and, you know, it was in various Indigenous languages and Portuguese, but the feeling I got was it actually was quite rare for Brazilians to have what we would call an intergroup dialogue. And I attended the University of Michigan, one of the focal points for intergroup dialogue. Our listeners might be interested in the work of Mike Spencer and Lorraine Gutierrez and others who use this model. Mm-hmm. But back to Brazil, you had indigenous people from the Amazon, maybe with an indigenous spirituality. You had Afro-Brazilians who kept some of the traditions of Africa alive in Brazil. And then you had people who were Catholic or maybe Protestant having a dialogue of how this related to sustainability. Mm-hmm. Is that the most important thing to discuss? I don't know, but it was important to the people there. And for some reason, major institutions thought it was important. And mm-hmm. it wasn't something I would think that they would think is important.
Well, I think, you know, we get a pretty good idea of what happened at the summit and your experiences there. And it's interesting to know that you were part of EcoCity Boulders and that's who you represented at the summit. And, you know, thank you for, you know, those wonderful insights. That's really good to know and hopefully very useful for social workers working from a structural standpoint. So a related question, what advice do you have for social work practitioners who are interested in one of the three-legged stools? And how can they promote the achievement of sustainable development through their work? And I know, you know, there are individual level factors, like, you know, changes in behaviors individually, like recycling or using just cold water in your laundry. And then there's the demand for change on a more systemic level in the form of asking that corporations are taxed for carbon more strongly and so on. But how do you combine the two and how do you educate students to educate others?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that you have to start with the roots of social work. And, you know, I always take my students back to the London poverty surveys. I take them back to the maps created by Jane Addams, by mm-hmm. W.E.B. Du Bois. I always make mm-hmm. sure to highlight that W.E.B. Du Bois was a social worker. He ran a settlement house in Philadelphia. And they were working in neighborhoods, in places, yeah. and they were trying to improve the environment of those places. So they had maps of the language spoken in every house or townhouse or apartment building. Mm-hmm. They mapped poverty levels. They mapped also real or perceived environmental contaminants, like what sewers have miasma. Miasma was the term for odors that were so bad that you wanted to vomit. Because it didn't take a PhD to know if the environment was terrible, that well-being of families would suffer. Now, of course, it takes a PhD to deny this, but so I think that's the starting point. One of the problems I struggle with is I start there, and then a lot of students stay there. They think, well, this happened 100 years ago. It's completely irrelevant today. It's never more relevant. It's never been more relevant. Mm-hmm. So I think the answer is different if you have to put bluntly, having exposure on both the East Coast and West Coast. In the West Coast, they call the Midwest the East Coast for some reason. I just let that slide. In the West Coast, the schools of social welfare, as they're called, they tend to focus on populations. So you would do a child welfare track or an aging track, a health or mental health track. Mm-hmm. And then out east, usually it's some sort of clinical track or a quote-unquote macro or management track. And then maybe you have certificates and you can kind of mix and match population. Right. Or as at Michigan, they said practice area, practice method. Very complicated. So if you are a clinical social worker, you have to understand the impact of the physical environment on your clients, period.
Absolutely, yes.
And if you don't, quite frankly, that's malpractice. Eileen Gambrill wrote the lead article in the Council for Social Work Education's journal, the Journal for Social Work Education. Mm-hmm. And she lays this out very clearly. Mm-hmm. Eileen Gambrill is a clinical social worker. Right. She has a PhD in psychology and social work from the mm-hmm. University of Michigan. She's one of the top experts. She introduced cognitive behavioral therapy to social work. And she's like the lone voice in the wilderness sometimes.
That's a really good point. I do think that it's important to focus on the structural and the system and the social and the environment in order to understand how that affects the individual. And taking the mental health approach is good, but only if you take it into context of the environment. And so thank you for making that really important point. And that really is the basis of social work. Like when you mentioned Jane Addams, that's what her work was. And that's how we need to move forward. That's a really good point.
Yeah, and I think, like, I am not a clinical social worker. I'm grateful for clinical social work. I've been a consumer of clinical social work services. I don't think that's anything to be ashamed of.
Right.
I had a much better experience with clinical social workers than, say, other professions that do similar work. But I was trained mostly in community organization and social policy. So I have two starting points. One in the community with community-based organizations, and one in bureaucracy. I tell my students, by the end of my class, you'll love bureaucracy. And they don't believe me. And at the end of the class, they still don't believe me.
Maybe they do. They just don't admit it.
Yeah. But in the community, for example, currently I work with a food security and workforce development organization called Focus Hope in Detroit. This organization was responsible for advocating at the national level to get the U.S. Department of Agriculture to have a commodities food program. So anyone in the United States who has ever used the commodities food program mm-hmm. has Detroit to thank for that. Mm-hmm. But what they've noticed is, even though they've been very successful as an organization, the neighborhood that they live in has been struggling. It was a nice middle-class neighborhood in 1960. Today, it has severe challenges with blight, with crime. So I've been working with them on their community indicators. Just like with the EcoCity Citizen Map, they have now a data collection on mobile devices. And as soon as it's answered, it goes into the cloud. They can do their community assessment. So, you know, Focus Hope is doing sustainability initiatives. They're working bringing a greenway through the neighborhood with the Greenway Alliance that will allow for outdoor recreation opportunities, walking, biking. It could even, during weather permitting, provide a great commuting alternative to downtown. They are working on the blight. They're going to do work with next summer, I think it's the Evangelical Lutheran Church is having a congress in Detroit, and so they will have 5,000 volunteers who will work with Focus Hope to clean lots, plant trees, board up blighted buildings. I spent a good amount of May last summer working on their sustainability and community indicators to inform their survey, the surveys that they will do in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not unusual for social workers to do. This is what we do. Right. But we can do it now in a way that's cognizant of, coordinated with various environmental issues.
Okay, I'll ask you my last question. And that really is, you know, just your take on, you know, for long we've talked about proliferation of NGOs as a sign of, again, market failure, government failure, them not being able to take responsibility of things that they should be taking responsibility of. So what do you make of this increased NGOization in the United States, as you've talked about in Detroit and other places?
Yeah, that's a great question. It certainly is a conversation Detroiters have. Some applaud NGOization as a new era of cooperation, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. Others are very suspicious that it's really the neoliberal agenda. So in other words, that the market has commodified all areas of life and it is squeezing out social life. Mm-hmm. So I go back often to Jürgen Habermas. You know, it's not just market failure, but also the legitimation crisis that occurs with the state. The market has failed. And I think that's with the global economic collapse of 2008, we could see the market failed. Mm-hmm. But by the same time, there's limits to what various levels of government can do. And I think there's limits to what publicly traded corporations can do. Mm-hmm. There's limits to what privately held corporations can do. Mm-hmm. And I think to move forward, we have to have a realistic discussion of what different sectors can accomplish and how they work in terms of a network, especially at the local level. And that has to be rooted in a vision of social justice that, you know, I'm an old-timey co-oper. Like, I believe in the value of one person, one vote. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the market value is one share, one vote. If one person buys 100 shares, he or she gets 100 votes, right?
Right.
We have to have a strong voice as social workers to say, for issues of public concern, you know, it's got to be one person, one vote. Maybe that's an adult person. We could debate about citizenship. But to me, that's fundamental to moving forward, because as long as decisions are made by a handful of people, they will never have the access to information needed to make a decision that's good for the public.
Okay. Well, to one person, one vote. Thank you so much, Dr. Richard, and I hope we can do this again.
You've been listening to Dr. Richard Smith discuss sustainable development and social work practice on In the Social Work.
Hi, I'm Nancy Smith, Professor and Dean of the University of Buffalo School of Social Work. Thanks for listening to our podcast. We look forward to your continued support of the series. For more information about who we are as a school, our history, our online and on-the-ground degree and continuing education programs, we invite you to visit our website at www.socialwork.buffalo.edu. And while you're there, check out our Technology and Social Work Resource Center. You'll find it under the Community Resources menu.